Everyone, and welcome to Minute 101 of Season 8 of Movie Rob Minute, the Daily Podcast, where we foobar our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again this season, after taking a little break, just to have to stay away from, Jeremy Irons a little bit, is Duncan Shields of Chronologically Speaking. Welcome back to the show, Duncan.
Hey there. I'm happy to be back.
I guess you need to take a little break from these every so often, so it makes sense. It's fine.
Yeah.
All right, but I'm glad to have you back here on this season.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm happy to be here too. It's a wonderful excuse to rewatch this film.
Okay, all right. So why don't you actually start telling us your history with this movie? Do you remember when you first saw it? What are your thoughts on the movie in general? Things like that.
Well, it's an interesting experience watching a movie like this because it's hard to... Whenever I think of the nature of war, right, I think of, like, there's two things that are really hard to capture in movies. One's a biopic. You want to capture a person's entire life in 90 minutes or 2 hours. That's going to be impossible to do. And to accurately capture, like, the horrors of war or the complexities of war in a movie is also really hard to do because you got to be, I guess, fair to both sides. But when we're talking about World War II, how do you go about doing that? there's a trapping in movies of it being, just like flag waving propaganda, which is, it gets a little, I'm on board with the heroes of the film. I'm on board with the story of the film. But once we get into, everybody stand for the American anthem, I'm like, well, let's just, that's not quite what I'm here for. But I'm here for a good movie, and I know that every soldier involved that gave their lives is a tragedy or is worthy of, some sort of medal. But it was good to see this movie. The first time I saw it must have been just in a big theater because it was a big deal movie when it came out. This wasn't some under the radar. This was a giant juggernaut of a movie that came out. That's the way I remember it anyway. And at the time, there was like a couple of big stars and a bunch of unknowns. And, I'm sure you've talked about this already, but like to watch it when it came out versus watching it now, there's like, it's easier to list who isn't famous now in this movie.
Most of these guys weren't famous either. This movie basically made most of those guys, recognizable, I guess you can say, for lack of a better phrase.
Yeah. There's only a couple that that aren't, and I don't know. There's a few movies like that, like Diner, I guess.
Okay. Yeah.
Breakfast Club, I guess. There's a couple of movies out there where the cast, pretty much the entire cast, just like exploded afterwards and had huge careers. I don't think I've ever seen it on a scale like Saving Private Ryan. There's like 20 people, or like 25 people who have since become household names that are in this movie that were nobody at the time.
That's very true. And it's great watching them here because it makes you wonder, did the movie make them famous? Or was it that Spielberg just is that good that he knew how to pick the guys that would eventually know how to break out? This is a guy, Barry Pepper. Wow, this is a guy that he has a future. I'm going to put him in this movie.
Vancouver, Vancouver's own Barry Pepper. He's from Vancouver.
There you go. We'll never know the real answer to that as to nobody will even tell us. No one will tell us the truth on that with everything.
it's a mystery to everybody involved, maybe there was just a confluence of events.
But I'm saying, right? Even if it is true, or even if it was just an accident, nobody will tell you it was an accident.
The whole time.
Yeah, it's It's definitely one of those things that you just have to deal with. For better, for worse.
Yeah, it could be a combo of, like, he recognized their talent, the movie turned out to be great, but also all of them behind the scenes were really good to work with as well. Like, I think that's something that gets lost in the conversation, is that there's people that are like, you see them in movie after movie after movie, and perhaps you don't particularly care for their performances, and you're like, how does this person keep getting work? And it's like, 9 times out of 10, it's because they show up on time, they work really hard, and they're a pleasure to be there around. Right? And it's like, what ends up on screen is almost not quite secondary. Like, they could do the job, but, like, there's someone that is wanted back on set, right? That you get a really brilliant genius who's a horrible, horrible person to be around. Like, they get, you know, brought on, and people suffer through their presence just because they know the movie's going to make a whole bunch of money because they're in it. But once in a while, you get both in the same package. Like, I've heard nothing but good stuff about Gary Oldman these days, about how every production he's a part of, people are just like, oh, Gary, he's the best, you know, and he's an incredible actor. So sometimes they can be both in the same package, which is great.
Definitely seems that way. And I mean, is this a movie that you revisit on a regular basis, or only when you're being asked to be on a podcast to talk about it minute by minute?
Yeah, I wouldn't. I don't think I would have gone back to it without being on a podcast about it. It's not something that I revisit regularly, because it has its trappings, and it has moments that I really enjoyed. But I don't. I can't see myself giving it too many rewatches. But I'm really glad that I was called to watch it again for this, because I was like, it was really interesting seeing this movie for a second time so many years later. Or I've probably seen it. This was probably my third or fourth time seeing it, maybe. I think I've seen it once or twice since it came out. Yeah, good stuff.
Okay, I mean, that's pretty impressive that you were interested in diving into it after having only seen it once, you know, 27 years ago. Which means
nonsense. It was 12 years ago. Nonsense. Okay.
but still. Wait, are we folding time? Is that the way this is working here? Yeah. I mean,
yeah. Of course. Hopefully.
Got it. All right. Excellent. So minute 101 begins with Miller finally letting the cat out of the bag, and ends with Miller continuing his speech. So, I mean, we ended things on Friday with Mike and Ryben starting to get a little bit upset at one another. Mike even reaches the point where he pulls out a gun, you know, and starts pointing it at Ryben and, you know, says some not necessarily nice things. Let's keep it at that. And, you know, Miller, who wants to just make peace, decides that, okay, he's going to break this up. And he starts, you know, just talking out of the blue about the pool on him, which, you know, it goes to show about the fact that, you know, this is the perfect time for him to bring it up. You know, in the scene when he was in the church, so you know, Upham brought it up and whatever. So, you know, he knew about it, but here we are, a day or two later, whatever it is, and this is the opportune time for him to bring it up and to try to break the ice and break the tension of everything that's going on. You know, and he started asking at the end of Friday's episode, he was asking, well, you know, what are they up to? Are they up to 300? Is that it? $300? And this minute begins with him just blurting out, I'm a school teacher. I teach English composition in a little town called Adley, Pennsylvania. The last 11 years, I've been at Thomas Alva Edison High School. I was the coach of the baseball team in the springtime. And I love the way that everyone is just silent as he's telling this. You know, they're all captivated by the fact that Miller is finally opening up to them. You know, he's been keeping things away from them for so long. And, you know, even in this tense situation, he's finally saying, okay, you know, I'm gonna tell you guys who I really am. And Mike just looks at him and goes, I'll be doggone. And then Miller continues with his little speech. He goes, back home, when I tell people what I do for a living, they think, well, that figures. But over here, it's a big mystery. But I guess I've changed some. Sometimes I wonder if I've changed so much. My wife is even going to recognize me whenever it is that I get back to her. So first of all, this is an amazing speech. You know, I mean, we'll continue with it tomorrow with the more of the speech, and you know, it ends at the end of tomorrow's episode. But still, you know, this speech was written. This is basically the Oscar clip speech.
One of two. Yeah, I concur that this is perhaps the more subtle of the two Oscar speeches, correct, for sure.
But the whole idea here is, I mean, what, you know, being the first time that we watch this movie, we're also shocked about this. No one will even, you know, think about the fact that it's possible that he's a teacher, you know, of all the things that he could be, you know, because here you have this soldier who is, or this commander that's so great at what he's doing. You know, he knows how to deal with every single situation that he's come across up until now. You know, and then once you know that he's a teacher, even though they've given us a few little clues along the way, but once you really know that he's a teacher, you know, on the one hand you say, okay, that sort of makes sense that a teacher would act the way that he is acting, you know, throughout the course of this movie. You know, the way that his character is every so often throwing out terms here and there, you know, talking about Emerson and talking about, different parts of, I guess, literature or history that people wouldn't necessarily know. But on the other hand, he's an excellent soldier. He's an excellent officer. He's able to read maps. He's able to figure out plans, you know, all these different things. This is all, you know, it's the same skill set, I guess, in some ways.
Yeah, and I can imagine that handling a room full of high school students, when you're in charge of a bunch of soldiers whose average age is 20 or 19, or well, I guess 19 was more like Vietnam. I don't know. Do you know what the average age in World War II was? Because it wasn't a draft, right?
Was it a draft in World War II? It wasn't a draft, but it was everybody wanted to volunteer. That was the idea.
Everybody was, really into it, right? So everybody wanted
volunteer. There were 17, 18-year-olds that were volunteering, for sure.
So it's not so different from, it's just like higher stakes or whatever. If you're teaching a squad full of young soldiers, you're getting them to stop squabbling. Like, I love, there's a couple of scenes in movies that I really like when somebody is so calm under fire. You're like, are you listening to what's happening around you? Like, are you a robot? Like, there was a bit in Band of Brothers, I think, where there's this group of men that have held a bridge for a super long time, for like 6 weeks. You know, there was 200 of them. Now there's 20. Then 50 more arrived. Then 30 of those people got killed, you know, but they've held the bridge. And then this brand new officer arrives. And, you know, the one officer that's been there since the beginning is like, hello, brand new officer. And he's like, well, how's it going here? You boys are handling this bridge really well. I tell you, the trip here was a little rough, very bumpy, but I'm really glad to be here, and I hope we can get down to business, and I want to meet the men. And everybody just kind of looks at him like he's an alien.
And that's,
right?
That's
like,
Tom Hanks' son, actually, who plays that character. That's Colin Hanks.
Colin Hanks? Oh, fantastic. How wonderful. And I liked how because the guy that just stares at him in silence and then turns away with the red stubble, he was always kind of...
Character's name is Don Malarkey.
Okay. But more of a sitcom guy. And he always kind of played like perky, fresh-faced, baby-faced kind of characters.
Scott Grimes.
Yeah, Grimes, that's right. Scott Grimes, yeah. Right, exactly. And then, but in this one, oh, that's right, from the Orville, right?
I believe he's also in the Orville.
Yeah,
I know him more. I remember him from ER. He was on ER for a number of seasons.
That's right.
Towards the beginning. I mean, he was a child actor. He was a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah, as a child actor, and I'd seen him a whole bunch of times as a child, so I never in a million years would have bought him as a grizzled veteran, but in that moment I did, and I was like, acting! You've got it, my boy. Well done. You know, that was really good. But that when the bullets are flying and the person in charge is not at all fussed. And this is definitely one of those things where it's like, dude, two of your guys, you know, one of them just pulled a gun on the other one. Like, it's really going off the rails. And he's just like, what's the pool up to now? Was it 300? Is it like $300? You know, and like everybody's like, dude, but this is why he's a commander. Like he knows how to keep things under wraps. But you know from his shaking hand and the breakdown he has not too far after this that like, you know, it's like that scene in the Avengers when the guy says, "That's my secret, Doc. I'm always right. angry," and like turns into the Hulk or whatever. It's like he's not calm. You know, he's just always at an 11, but he's learned how to live right. there. And as any doctor can tell you, it's a horrible place to live. Physiologically, it burns you out very quick. You don't last very long if you're at a stress level of that level for too long. You can be a leader in business, a commander in a war, whatever it may be. You can't live there for too long. But it becomes apparent here that that's where Hanks is living. And I love that. He's got this in his back pocket. Like, I think he's intentionally not letting them know what he does for a living, specifically for when a moment gets this bad.
I actually would slightly disagree with you on that. I think he was keeping that in his back pocket for the very fact that he doesn't want them to think differently of him. Okay, he wants them to follow his orders. And if he just tells them, you know, just tells them, I'm just a teacher who coaches the baseball team. You know, it's like these guys are going to say, well, why is this the guy who's taking us through, through Normandy? We want someone who has more.
Yeah, he's no longer this mythical sort of leader.
Right. So they wanted that he wants that mythical leader type of persona.
That's a good take on it. I can concur with that. But I think he also knows that this is going to – the information that he has is
sure.
going to defuse the situation.
I completely agree with you on that. And I think – but you know, I think the difference is that I don't think that was his original plan. You know, he wasn't holding on to that as a wild card.
Yeah.
Saying, okay, one day I'm going to need it and I'm going to throw out this wild card and tell everyone that I'm a teacher.
An ace up his sleeve. I think it was, but I think there's room for us both to be right on this. I think he didn't want to tell them because he didn't want to ruin it. But also in that moment, he's like, oh, okay,
right.
Now's the time.
He definitely knows that this is the right time to do this. There's no question about that.
And part of this speech that I really like is there's a book called All Quiet on the Western Front.
There's two movies about it.
It tries... Yeah, really good. I've seen the recent one, and it left out the most important part of the book in my eyes. And I haven't seen the earlier one that was made about it, but I want to. But what the book makes clear is that if you go to war, the horror is coming back. Like there's things you like. There's a saying I remember: no one ever comes home from a war. Right, like there's people that when you're in a war, when you come back, you're not the person you were when you left. And ordinary life, like just going to McDonald's and ordering a meal, is an alien experience for you. And when you're used to altercations, when you're used to being professionally violent, when murder becomes somewhat commonplace for you, functioning in a society afterwards. With manners and politeness, feels like you've gone nuts. And so that whole shift in perspective, or you go back and you meet somebody who's never been on the front and they're like, oh, you guys are cowards. I tell you what I would have done if I was there. You guys, you didn't try hard enough, you know, and you're back in your hometown talking to somebody who never went. And a lot of your friends are dead. And it takes everything you have in your being not to just kill this person right there on the street. You know, like, you're a different person now. And so that's the horror of war in my, or at least an aspect of it that was made clear in the book, is that when you come home, there's a whole new, weird, strange battle waiting for you, because everything's going to seem different through your changed eyes. And that's part of what Tom Hanks is talking about here, is he's like, when I go home, I don't know if my wife's going to know who I am. And that's a real fear. And it's weird, because I remember this moment differently. I remember him saying, over here, people are surprised to find out I was an English teacher. But over there, they thought it was strange I was going to join the army, that I wouldn't be a good soldier.
Okay.
Or something like that, like, which is a similar sentiment, but he doesn't mention what people thought about him becoming a soldier. So memory is a strange thing, right? And I think, but that was my takeaway from this moment. So watching it again and going, oh, I remembered it wrong, was really
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense though. Maybe like you read the novelization or something, and that's where it's in it.
No, I think I remember telling a few people about this scene because I liked it so much.
It is a common theme in war movies about, over the last 50, 60 years. You know, again, using the example of Alcoy and the Russian Front is a great example, because that's from 100 years ago that the novel was written. And, you know, not much has changed, unfortunately, from that perspective. You know, that war will change people, and you know, the idea is, you know, how do you get back into your life? How do you reacclimate yourself into life? And again, there've been tons of movies and books over the decades that deal with that aspect.
And I think you could translate All Quiet in the Western Front into ancient Latin, and Romans could read it and be like, oh man, that is so true. You know, like, I think that there's an essential truth of
right.
Of it there.
Are you familiar with The Best Years of Our Lives?
Yes. Yeah, I am.
Okay. So, see, there you go. That's another example from the 1940s, 1946. Yeah. It's a movie all about how these three guys, who each of them have been affected very differently by the war. You know, one of them physically, another one... was basically shell shocked, and the third one was just dealing with getting back into into the way that life moves things and stuff like that. And it's just done so well from that perspective.
Yeah, it was in the beginning of Peaky Blinders, I think it was the first or second episode. They're all in the back of their Irish pub talking, and one of them's like, you know, your brother Johnny's in the front and he's wrecking the place. And they're like, oh geez, and they all rush out, and there's this giant guy, and he's like throwing chairs and stuff like that, and all the guys surround him, and they just hug him and they hold on to him until he starts calming down, because he's back from the war. And he's having like a PTSD flashback. He's got shell shock from World War One or whatever. He's freaking out. And instead of like, you know, beating him or subduing him and throwing him out, they just hold him, because they know, because they're all veterans at this point, right? Every young man in Ireland at that point is a veteran. And so like, they're like, they just hold on to him until the fugue passes, kind of thing. And I thought that was a really beautiful moment.
Oh, wow. Okay, so a couple questions for you. So, you know, he mentions that he's from a little town called Adley, Pennsylvania.
I'm getting.
Do you know is it a real place or not?
It is a real place.
Actually, it is not.
What? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm looking at Hadley, Pennsylvania.
That's the what I was going to say. So Hadley, Pennsylvania, is not a real place.
Okay.
But there is a town called Hadley, Pennsylvania, which is in Mercer County. It's a pretty small place.
Yeah.
Not very big. They have. It was the little town was. Or is it, it's an unincorporated community.
That's a new term on me, an unincorporated community. I'm like, what does that mean? That's like me and my 10 buddies. Are we an unincorporated community? Like, what does that even mean? You know.
Interesting. It could be. But there's a man named David Hadley, who was born in 1806 and passed away in 1884 at the age of 77. And he was a shoemaker. And decided to start building mills. And since they're not that far from the Great Lakes,
yeah,
when they started building the railroad to get across it, so he erected a station in order for, people to, have a place to stop on the way.
That's right. And then they got a...
And he called the place Hadley. And then he established a post office. So he established a post office
in
May of 1868, and they opened a barrel factory in the same year, which became very important in that area. They organized a Presbyterian church in 1875, and then they had a Methodist church that was built in 1882. So it's a relatively small place.
Yeah, it's a relatively small place, but you're kind of, it's like it's a, kind of a nice little rundown of the bare minimum needed to exist as a town. You need post office, barrel factory, a church or two, train station, right? You gotta have two churches. You can't have a town with one church. That's not a town. That's an outpost. There's got to be factions. Otherwise, it's not right. A city.
Well, again, it goes with the, there's an old joke. I mean, you could probably use it in just about any for any religion. I've always heard it as Jewish, so I'll just say it as Jewish.
Doesn't yeah.
make a difference. Yeah, you know, they finally reach a deserted island, and they find this stranded Jew that's been there for many years, and they're he's showing them around the island, and showing, okay, this is where I did this, and this is where I did that. And this is here are the two synagogues. And they look at him and they go, why do you need two synagogues? Well, this is the one I go and pray in, and this is the one I'll never step foot in.
Yeah, I wouldn't be caught dead in that one.
It's the same idea. I guess you have to have two churches in the town just for that very reason. You know, you have the place to say, oh, that's the church I won't go to.
There was an interesting thing here in the on the page on Hadley. It says, several years after the post office was established, the town was platted. And I was like, what does platted mean? And that just means make a map of the area or plan out. So it means that when they say, now this city's on the map, that's literally what they mean. The term for it would be platted.
Interesting. Instead of saying it's mapped.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a derivation of plotted, but...
Could be.
Okay.
Okay, so he mentions that he was working in Thomas Alva Edison High School. How many Edison high schools do you think there are in the U.S.?
I'm going to go with 26.
You would be very close. There are only 21.
Hey, all right. Not too bad.
Yeah. And we're not even going to go into the number of how many Edison schools there are. There's a ton of them all
sure.
over the country and stuff like that. But I actually found some very interesting things about places or things that were named after Thomas Edison.
Oh, okay.
So there's obviously the most notable is the town of Edison, New Jersey,
mm-hmm.
which is where not too far from Menlo Park where he lived. They also have the Thomas Edison State University, which is in Trenton, New Jersey.
Trenton,
they have two community colleges. Trenton's the capital of New Jersey.
Right.
They have two community colleges. That are named after him, the Edison State College, which is in Fort Myer, Florida, in the Edison Community College in Peek, Ohio. Wow. There is a science hall.
Where? At Peek?
Peek. E-I-Q-U-A.
Peek?
Peek,
Ohio. Peek. Wow. Yeah. Peek, Ohio.
Yeah.
I love it. And it's not P-E-A-K, it's P-I-Q-U-E.
Nope. P-I-Q-U-A. There is a Thomas Alva Edison Science Hall at Monmouth University in West Long Branch, New Jersey. Then the soccer player, Pelé, his father originally wanted to name him Edison after Edison. But what happened was is that they incorrectly wrote his name on his birth certificate as Edson. Which is why that's his name. It's not Edison. It's Edson. E-D-S-O-N.
Right. I see.
The City Hotel in Sunbury, Pennsylvania, was the first building to be lit with Edison's light bulbs. So the hotel was renamed the Hotel Edison 40 years later, in 1922. There is a Lake Thomas Edison in California.
In California? Wow, that far east, that far west. Okay.
That's right, which they named in 1954 to mark the 75th anniversary of the light bulb. There is a Hotel Edison in New York City, which opened in 1931, which Edison actually showed up to turn on the lights, you know, in that hotel. There are three bridges in the U.S. that are named in Edison's honor. You have the Edison Bridge in New Jersey, the Edison Bridge in Florida, and the Edison Bridge in Ohio, which I guess that goes along with what we were saying before about, having the, colleges in Fort Myer, Florida, and Pekah, Ohio.
Yeah.
Whether they're close by or not.
Yeah, because he was born in Ohio, right?
That's right. There is a mountain peak in Alaska named Mount Edison.
Okie doke, Alaska. Wow. Okay, now we're getting really far afield.
Which was named in 1955 for him. The house that Edison grew up in Ohio was renamed the Thomas Alva Edison Birthplace Museum.
Okay.
In what else do we got here? There are a whole bunch of museums. There's the
no doubt.
There's an Edison Museum in Beaumont, Texas, but Edison was never there. I don't really know how that. Now in Detroit, the area where I grew up, so they have the Edison Memorial Fountain in the Grand Circus Park. And they dedicated that in 1929 on the 50th anniversary of the creation of the light bulb. And they also dedicated the Edison Institute in Dearborn, which, was not so far away.
Yes.
He was inducted into the Automotive Hall of Fame in 1969. And
that's fairly late, 1969. Okay. Posthumously, I assume.
Yeah. He was posthumous. There are a bunch of companies that are named after it. The one I'm going to mention is Detroit Edison, which again, growing up in Detroit, that was the electric company. It's Detroit Edison. Which I never really made the connection between Edison and the electricity, but oh well. There is a naval ship known as the USS Edison, which is a Gleaves-class destroyer that was christened in 1940. It fought all through World War II and then was decommissioned. And then in 1962, they commissioned another ship called the USS Thomas A. Edison, which is a ballistic missile nuclear power submarine. Which I guess sort of makes sense also. Electricity, sort of.
Yeah, he gets a lot of props, but there's also some what do you call it? Not Scandal, but oh God, who? Oh no, I'm thinking of something else. Who's
We're
the
talking about
guy?
the movie.
No, I'm
No, it's the
talking
movie.
about. Is the guy that did he have a lot of run-ins with Tesla? Or am I thinking
I
of some?
believe so. I believe so. But his biggest feud was with George's Malaise, the who was a movie director in the early 1900s, because Edison kept stealing all of his ideas.
Yeah, so there was yeah, they were yeah, they both had competing visions for power of the United States. I remember somebody was saying that they should change the name of the Tesla to the Edison because well, I don't know. I don't remember it. It was sort of a burn, but what I
Makes
didn't
sense.
know, I didn't know that that Edison's parents were Canadians.
Ooh, there you go.
Yeah, they were his dad was a Dutch Canadian and his mom was a Scottish Canadian, and they both had to flee to the States for participating in the rebellion of 1837 on the wrong side there, which is part of why the White House is white, because they tried to annex Canada and Canada said, forget it, and beat them all the way back to Washington and burned down the president's house at the time. So they rebuilt it, and when they rebuilt it, they made it it was the White House. But the place that was there before was burned down by Canadians. So that's what happened in the Rebellion of 1837. And of course, okay, so I guess, yeah, they had to flee because of that, understandably, and that's why he grew up as an American. I had no idea.
Interesting. Okay. And that's all I have to say about this minute. Did
Me
you have
too.
anything else?
Nope, that's good.
All right, so every Monday we have a segment called Maestro Monday, where my guests will give their top five John Williams movie theme scores, however you want to refer to that. So, Duncan, why don't you start off with your number five and work your way up?
So many to choose from, but I guess I would have to go number five, Harry Potter. Number four, Jaws. And I remember him talking to Spielberg. He talks about talking to Spielberg about it. And Spielberg was like, okay, what have you got for me? After he'd been gone for like 3 weeks working on the theme to Steven Spielberg's new shark movie. And he goes over to the piano and he goes like, da da, da da. And Steven Spielberg is like, ha. Oh, that's hilarious. What a good joke you just did. That's so funny. I love sarcasm too, but no, but seriously, what theme did you come up with? And he's like, I'm not joking, that's the theme I came up with, you know, but then it turns out to be this super iconic thing. Number three would be Raiders, of course. Beautiful, Raiders of the Lost Ark, that whole theme's incredible. Superman would be my number two. And probably Star Wars has to be number one. That's just the opening fanfare, and you know, I saw Star Wars. Oh boy, what was I, seven, eight? It came out in 77, right? So I was 8 years old, and or maybe even six. Yeah, no, I would have been like 6 years old. So it was like a nuclear bomb inside, you know, everything that I am as a person. Like a pretty incredible. So that theme song is part of my DNA for sure.
Okay, very cool. All right, so Duncan, would you like to tell everyone where they can find Duncan Shields?
If you just go to like Instagram, you know, Twitter for a little bit longer, maybe a few places, look for By Duncan Shields, and you'll probably find me there, Shields. And if also if you want to Google Tronologically Speaking, which was the Movie by Minute podcast that I did on 1982's Tron. You'll find that on all your favorite podcast providers. And also, if you take a look, we're almost across the finish line on the Time Bandits Minute when me and Curtis plays. So if you look for the Time Bandits Minute, you'll find a wonderful 98% of the movie Time Bandits investigated minute by minute by me and my co-host Curtis Blaze.
Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, Earn this.
Earn this. My solitude.